This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to see y'all. What a lovely place. Their trees came to listen to the Dharma talk. That's very nice. Open to the outside. Yeah, so I hope you're doing well, however you're doing. I'm glad we're here together. There's space for however you are and whoever you are. I think the idea is to do things with some simplicity and some care for the next couple days. You might think, this doesn't seem simple. It's like, I have to walk around the room some funny way, or how do I even hold this spoon? And I understand, you know, it can feel that way, and that's okay. How many times do I hit this bing, bing? Yeah, it can feel that way. That's okay. But it isn't really that complicated. It's like you lift up a bowl and you put it back down. You ask for some food and you receive the food. Someone cooks the food. Someone eats the food. So even though it may seem not simple, and that's okay, and we can care for whatever that is, we can just look for the simplicity of just doing this thing. And if we're confused about what to do, then the thing is like opening our field of awareness and being like, oh, look, someone else is doing it. Maybe they're going to show me the way. That's why we have friends on the path. So I'm going to talk about Vasubandhu's three natures over the course of the weekend, and oftentimes I teach these in a very discursive way. Vasubandhu makes a very clear, developed argument about them to like lay them out for us. And I'm sorry to say that's just not going to happen for the next 2 days because during Sesshin, I think it's helpful to have a teaching that's less disordered because we're letting the mind soften in its need for like and kind of open up to something more relational. So probably the most clear explication of the three natures I will give on Sunday morning when the general public comes in and they're ready for something that's a little more but here we may have something a little more flowing. And probably the progression of talks, we have four talks today, two each today and tomorrow. And this first one, I will just talk, and then there will not be time for question or comment. And the more we are together, the more space that I will make for other voices so that there can be some opportunity for me to present the material so you have some room to process it before you start. We start working it relationally. I'll be available to meet with you one-to-one for Dokusan. Monica will kindly make a sort of a practical announcement about how to get to the room and whatnot. You know, people do Dokusan very differently. I have some friends who are founded the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care. I was there giving a talk and during the Zazen beforehand, there was all these bells ringing for Dokusans, ding, every few minutes. Afterwards, I said, "How long do you spend on Dokusan with your students?" They said, "Oh, 5 minutes." I said, "How long do you spend?" I said, "Well, during retreat, I like 15 or 20 minutes, and then for like monthly meetings, about a half an hour." And they said, "What do you talk about?" People do things differently. That's cool. So, just so you have some clarity about what I'm going to do, when you come in, I'll just sit quietly. And after you've had some time to settle, I'll bow. If you want to sit in a chair, just move the chair onto the cushion where the cushion is, and I'll move a chair and sit in a chair with you. And then we could just sit quietly for a minute. I'll bow, and then I'll say hello. And then I just invite you to bring whatever is on your heart. So I understand this to be about me supporting your practice. And what practice to me means is what you do. And in particular, it means what you do to embody the vow to liberate all beings from suffering. So, you might just be like, "I don't even know what that means." Well, that's a good topic of conversation. Or you might just be like, "Oh, I'm pretty good at liberating all beings except for right now when I want to jump out a window or whatever." So, yeah, just whatever is on your heart about the way you're living and the way you're experiencing things and how that relates to the possibility that we can all be free from suffering. I will use the term liberation and freedom quite a bit, and I like to be explicit. I'm talking about liberation from suffering. So I think sometimes that gets confusing. Yeah. So anyway, it's all space. That's what I'll try and make some space for you. Ooh. So Vasubandhu is a fourth or fifth century Buddhist Indian monk who had an enormous impact on Buddhism, in particular East Asian and Tibetan Buddhisms, where texts that he wrote have been regular parts of study for since the time of his life until now. And I'm just not all that interested in talking about history during sessions, so that's what you get. I'll say Vasubandhu is associated with, in later in life, he was associated with a movement called Yogacara, which means yoga practice, which is about integrating early Buddhist psychology with the Mahayana emphasis on collective and universal liberation. So this is about bringing the tools that early Buddhism gives us for caring for the self and finding a sense of personal liberation, even as we embody and open up to the possibility of living for everyone's freedom. So, this is particularly important to me as I work with many different groups who are focused on helping people be free from harmful patterns like racism and patriarchy, climate change, among many others. And this enables a framework for doing that work where people are really getting more free, but we can take care of ourselves and each other as we go. So it's not a path of horrifying burnout, which some of you may have tried. I certainly have. So the three natures are one of the main teachings of the Yogacara. The other big one a lot of people know about is the idea of the storehouse consciousness or the Alaya Vijnana, which probably will bubble up in the course of this weekend. This is it a weekend? Whatever. I'll call it a weekend. So the three natures, the three natures. The idea is that everything is of three natures. So anything that you experience in any way, as a sight, a sound, a smell, a thought, an emotion, a taste, or anything I left out, anything can be viewed, and it will be beneficial to view it as having these three natures or these three characteristics. That is the claim of the tradition. So the three natures are the imaginary, the dependent, and the complete realized natures. These are variously defined. I'll say very briefly, the imaginary nature of things is what you think they are. The dependent nature is that they appear the way they do, dependent on other things. And the complete realized nature is that they are not what you think they are. So the implications of this are really vast, but a couple really simple ones are: because things are imaginary, what you do always matters, because you are contributing to the way sentient beings will experience the world. So every moment we plant seeds that produce the kind of world we will live in. So what we do always matters. This is one of the main implications of things being imaginary in this system. That they are dependent means that everything is always collective. Always everything collective in the broadest, most mind-blowing, immense sense. But also in the smallest sense, where if you spill something and leave it there, someone at this retreat will end up cleaning it up. Thank you very much. But you could just clean it up yourself. There's no escaping our collectivity. And the implication, one big implication of the complete realized nature is that you're not broken. You can't control anything. Everything that Buddhism presents as an ideal of vast, limitless compassion is already here. And that might be a little hard to believe, but it's actually worth trying to take it in. Because then, instead of trying to make something else happen or get somewhere else through our actions, we can begin to just be able to trust the moment. To trust the moment, even when it's very fraught. And this helps people. It really helps people. When you can be around someone in a difficult situation, you can just trust this moment as complete and beyond their ideas of it. It could be very powerful. So, of course, I'm thinking about kimchi. How does the mind do anything, my friends? How does anything ever happen? It's very mysterious. So anyway, kimchi. Let's talk about the three natures of some kimchi, maybe in the acquisition of some kimchi. So I go to Shuanghe, which is my favorite neighborhood Asian market. And it's run by some predominantly Chinese folks. And I go, oh, I'm going to acquire this kimchi because I like it. I like to eat it. Tastes good to me. And I also think it's good for me. So it's good. I'm like, yay, I like this kimchi. Now the kimchi, I go to the store, line up, pay the money. And I'm like, now this kimchi is mine. So Yogacara teachings say it's useful in order to begin to understand the dependent nature of things to practice conceptualization of dependence. That just means thinking about how the thing you're perceiving depends on other things. So for many people, this is pretty familiar. This is like one of the principal things Thich Nhat Hanh uses relentlessly. And it's just really useful. You know, I get the kimchi and I'm like, wow, thank you. I mean, who grew this napa and this ginger? Wow, thank you so much. And, you know, what soil did it happen in? And what care does it take for that soil to be fertile so that this can grow? And I'm not going to talk about rain a lot because Californians know way more about rain than I do, both the impacts of the absence and the presence of rain. Wow. No kimchi without rain. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh has a great book called No Mud, No Lotus, but I think it should have been called No Rain, No Kimchi. That would have been much better. So, yeah, wow. And then there's microorganisms. Now, this is interesting because I'm going to eat the kimchi probably. Oh, yeah. Then there's a variety of views. See, I think kimchi is really nice, and my spouse thinks it's disgusting. Yeah. We're different. That's because things are of an imaginary nature. We experience them differently. It's important. Makes a big difference on how life works, just to be able to remember that. Anyway, yeah, there's these microorganisms in there. And I'm like, yeah, I got the kimchi. But the microorganisms are probably like, sweet, I got a body to go live in. It's really good in there. It's warm. I can propagate. I can meet some other microorganisms and have a whole dependent ecosystem in here. Wonderful. Whose perspective do we want to focus on here? And, you know, I'm like, this is my kimchi. So, like, if I was walking out the store and a kimchi thief came, I might be really uptight. It's like, oh, you stole my kimchi. Because it's mine. I think this is one of the more interesting things. Like, what are the dependent conditions that produce the belief I have that something could be mine? That's just a socially constructed phenomenon. It's not an absolutely true thing. But it seems so real, so obvious, so utterly absolute. But what does it mean that it's mine? What are the conditions that all the things people had to do? So, you know, we imagine it. It's imaginary nature is that it is mine. And although the dependent nature and the imaginary are related, the fact that it's imaginary emphasizes that it is mental and behavioral processes of sentient beings that create what we think things are. So people had to sort of take things, develop language for possession, and develop the whole cultural agreement system through actions of mind, of emotion, of body for thousands of years for me to be like, oh, this is my kimchi. And even though that's just a social construct and clearly isn't a real thing, because like, if a lightning bolt comes down and shatters the kimchi, was it mine? I don't know. Maybe it was the universe's. It wanted it back. Or if someone takes it, is it still mine? Once I eat it, is it still mine? Once it's in the waste system, is it still mine? But this is an important thing. So the complete realized nature of this kimchi and its mindness, or the fact that I possess it, is it's not real. It's not absolutely real. It's not what I think it is. But Buddhist teachings and Yogacara teachings don't say, oh, well, since it's not real, who cares? I should just go out and go up to people who have kimchi and be like, possession is an illusion. Eat their kimchi. No. Central to Buddhist practice is to uphold the precept not to take what is not given. So early Buddhism emphasizes seeing that things are dependent, and based on that seeing, withdrawing from harmful systems, systems like eating meat, systems like taking what is not given, systems like caste. The basic model is a viewing the system and renunciation. But in the Mahayana, people started to think, want to do something else. I'll put it that way. I want to do something else, which is a more engaged model. And so instead of focusing, although it's still there, on the precept of not to take what is not given, the emphasis in the Mahayana becomes that dana. So dana and the precept to take not to take what is not given are both parts of both traditions, but dana is emphasized in the Mahayana. So we emphasize actually giving, not just not taking, but giving. The first of the paramitas. This, I kind of find it hard to give. I get parsimonious. That's a fancy word. Stingy, tight-fisted. Ooh, I'm scared. If I give my money away, am I going to be okay? Going to be able to take care of my kids? Oh. So there's an opportunity to see my emotional state there. So one of the main implications of things being imaginary is that the way we imagine them matters to us. And so given that there's this field of things that we think are absolutely real, we should take care of them with some kindness. In this case, giving attention to the feeling. I forgot I was going to give you just a, I was going to give a little bit more of a abstract explication of the three natures here following the text, Vasubandhu's treatise on three natures. So Vasubandhu says, what appears is dependent, how it appears is the imaginary, and the constant absence of how it appears in what appears is known as the complete realized nature. It's almost, you start to think maybe it'll make sense, and then it gets so confusing. I know. What appears? So that means what we're talking about is, I don't know how to put it better than just like waving my hands and looking around. What is this? What? Something appears. Something isn't quite the right word, but the dependent nature is that there is some kind of somethingness right now for you, unless you're in a certain kind of samadhi where there's absolutely no experience whatsoever. But it looks like probably most of you are having some kind of thing you'd call an experience, or something is happening. So the dependent nature is that there's this moment. The imaginary nature is how it appears. So everything within the field of this moment that appears to be a thing is imaginary. So the mind, the patterned conditioned mind, is divided into probably self and other, my guess is. If that's not true for you right now, enjoy your enlightenment. It probably will come and go. Self and other probably feels like there are sensory experiences that are distinct. So like what is seen is a different thing than what is felt with the body. That's a mental distinction. I really don't think like a one-day-old baby makes that distinction. They're just like, whoa! I don't know. I've never talked to one about it. But anyway, the different sense fields all seem distinct. And then within the sense fields, there's all kinds of distinct stuff that we think is separate. Right? So that's the way that seems separate to us. That's how it appears. That's the imaginary. And the complete realized nature is just that all that stuff isn't absolutely real. It's just not absolutely real. Doesn't mean it doesn't matter, but it does mean that maybe we can be a little less freaked out about it. That would be nice. Do you ever get freaked out about what seems absolutely real? I do. I enjoy having a break from that. So, you know, I was thinking about possession, the idea that you can own something, which is just interesting. And then I was remembering this talk that someone gave at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, where I am usually based. And they quoted Suzuki Roshi, who once said, I think I have this right, strictly speaking, money does not belong to you. It belongs to the universe. Strictly speaking. A lot of times when he says strictly speaking, it seems like he's talking about sort of the absolute nature of things, which is like the complete realized nature of things. So I'm like, that sounds good, Suzuki Roshi, but I'm keeping my IRA. In part because I'm scared and want to protect myself. And in part because I recognize that in the culture that we have, that if I don't do that, it will be really difficult for other people. People are not going to want to see me living on the street. We have a culture where if you don't have any money, a lot of difficult things happen. And then if there are people who love you, it puts them in a difficult position. So the fact that things are imaginary does not mean they don't matter. And because they're collective, we can see the relational impact of our choices informed by our awareness of the three natures. In a way, Suzuki goes a little bit off from what these teachings says because he says the money belongs to the universe. And this would really say, well, there's not really any money and there's not really any universe. Those are just ideas. The idea that there's a universe that's somewhere outside there is not quite right because it's just an idea. But you can see he's pointing to something similar, that to the thing we think is separate that we can hold on to is part of something complete and whole and collective. And the dependent nature says it's collective, and the complete realized nature says it's complete and whole. So anyway, this teacher said this, quoted this Suzuki Roshi, strictly speaking, money does not belong to you, it belongs to the universe. And then someone got really mad. Someone got really mad. And they were like, I didn't come here to hear Marxism. Wow. Yeah, you could see they were angry, they felt anger. Wow. And so it was a great opportunity to just be like, oh, look at how you are. Anger is painful. Anger is painful to experience. What an opportunity to just pause and see this person, to try and do my best to understand their emotional state. Just as when I've been trained to practice Zazen, when an emotional state arises, just pause and just see it. I don't have to think about it. That's not the practice. I mean, thinking about it will likely happen. Just taste the feeling, just like I taste the oatmeal. Or I taste the way the light came into my room in the morning when the wake-up bell rang. Anyway, so the person was mad. And then I was really happy. The person giving the talk wasn't like, well, you're wrong. So let me explain to you why you're wrong. He took time. He said, oh, afterwards, he said, oh, this seemed like pretty activating. You want to talk about it? And I made space to talk about it. The fact that things are not complete realized nature points to the fact that there's not an absolute truth that you can hold on to or get. Which is an uncomfortable way of looking at things if you haven't noticed already. The whole no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, and no mind. Where am I? It's supposed to be a little disorienting, but it's very freeing at some point. Because then instead of trying to cling to absolute truths that can't be, cling to things that always go away, acquire things that can never be held on to. We can just realize it's flux and that our ideas have utility, but they're not the whole story. And then when we're with people and we disagree, instead of being like, well, as soon as you understand it the right way and do it the way I think it should happen, everything will be great. Or maybe you do this with yourself. As soon as I understand it the right way, you're going to come in here and sit Zazen for 2 days, 70 days, 500 years, you'll finally see it the right way and finally be okay. Oh, so real. We don't have to wait. basic message of Soto Zen Buddhism is you don't have to wait for liberation. When we're all standing here and no one knows what to do, you don't have to wait. You don't. It's like, wow, this is what it's like to not know what to do. Wonderful. I know it's painful for me sometimes. Oh, man. I tell you, like, George Floyd was murdered just a couple miles from my house, and the anguish in the community was so enormous. And, you know, I have different groups I work with. They've been working for years on racial justice issues, particularly around policing. And it's very painful. And I can tell you, like, not knowing what to do, it's like, what do you do when there's, like, white supremacists driving around your neighborhood planting bombs in everyone's backyards? Not everyone's, just some of ours. While other people are like, I'm going to burn down some buildings because I want people to wake up. What do you do? I didn't know. It was hard. For a lot of people, obviously. People all over the world. And clearly, more so Black people who are much more directly impacted by that circumstance. Regardless, I'm so grateful for all the years I spent with Thich Nhat Hanh and his teachings on the three natures and Vasubandhu, because I was like, I don't know what to do. Of course. That enabled me to stay in the body and to show up for people who I cared about, which is like everybody. Probably some more than others, I'll admit it. I got my special friends, my family. I imagine them to be distinct. And that matters. So I don't know. I have no idea what the outcome of the conversation between the teacher about his terrible Marxist Suzuki Roshi teachings on money and this other person. I don't know. But what came up was a relational process of trying to make some space for understanding. And I don't think there's any other. That's what liberation looks like to me. The relational process, moving around to Zendo, seeing the trees outside the window, serving someone food, receiving food. Hey, this is a cool, simple thing. I don't know how you do it here, but when we're serving seconds and the food comes to you, if you want food, just go in gassho. And if you don't go in gassho. And if we all know that's the plan, then you just don't serve people food who aren't in gassho. So it's pretty simple. When the seconds come, if you want food, and if you don't, and if the person isn't gassho, you can just move it on down the line. Very simple. Simple. Hopefully I didn't break Jikoji's style of... or Yoki. So the three natures kind of relate to different meditation styles differently. But one of the things I want to close this talk with, this will take a few minutes, is that because things are imaginary, the Yogacara teachings, they use that to integrate early Buddhist Abhidharma or psychology, because they say, we're imagining things some way. We see things as a bunch of distinct dualistic phenomena. That matters. So let's do it in a way that's helpful. It's pretty straightforward. And so then they say, given that that is true, here are some things that it would be really good to focus on. And ways to focus on them. So you get in Vasubandhu's 30 verses, a list of phenomena to notice. And it's somewhat complex. So just to say two things that are really key is to notice the sensations of the body and to notice whatever emotion is present. And if it's useful to name the emotion, that can be good. They have like lists of emotions, but I'm not going to recite those at the moment. You know, desire, aversion, delusion, pride, wrong view, doubt, whatever it is. You can just be like, ooh, arrogance. I think I'm really good at Oryoki and everyone else should just get it together. Oh, that's kind of there's a feeling there. They're like, I'm terrible. I'll never learn this. And everyone else understands that I'm, oh, yeah, that might come up. Some shame, not feeling like we fit in. So we can just notice, oh, that feeling is there. And if it's helpful, just name it. And here, knowing the body, I'm just going to invite you to actively bring concentration into your bodily sensations. And if you find it helpful, you could close your eyes, but you don't need to. And often, you know, we'll use attention to the breath. So just noticing the sensations in the belly as we breathe as the first element of the first foundation of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of body. So the first element is mindfulness of breathing. So here, sometimes we can get something happening where we sort of, I think like mechanically breathing. So maybe we're trying to be aware of the breath in order to avoid thinking, or because we think that's the correct way to practice. But just see if you can keep understanding what I'm saying while you bring attention into the body. Even if you're practicing shikantaza and not bringing active concentration to the body, you can still know the body as part of the whole field of experience. And I just invite you to think of like maybe you love some animals like a dog, or a cat, or a horse. I personally live with a rabbit who's very cute, almost incomprehensibly, transcendentally, unimaginably, world-endingly cute. Or maybe animals don't do it for you. You like some flowers or trees. But your practice might be to realize, oh, it's good for me to take time just being with my animal or with this tree or these plants that I'm gardening. You might have some sense that this is healthy for you. It's nice for them. It's kind of be de-stressing for you. It's kind of relaxing, long, stressful day. You just pet your dog or watch them sniffing things as you go on a walk, and it's nice. So notice, if you imagine something like this, you're not thinking, wow, if I just focus on this dog, I'll finally feel better, or then I'll be doing it right. Oh, it's natural. We want to bring this energy to the body. If we act like we love what's here, we plant seeds of loving what's here. And if you're like, oh, I can't summon that emotional energy, you don't really have to. I'm just kind of invoking this natural quality of care that attention has when it's not focused on an object, but is trying to get or accomplish or make happen. And the same thing, if feelings arise, you can just notice that feeling, just like you'd notice a rabbit hopping across your living room, or a horse nuzzling you across a fence. Or a flower that's just opening at dawn. Here, we're acknowledging the way we're imagining things to be right now, cultivating an approach that realizes relationships, so we're developing our sense of the dependent nature. And by softening our tendency to do this for some external object, to make something happen or get something, we open to the dependent nature that is already here. All right, folks. It's nice to be with you. I'd be very happy to hear your voices during Dokusan and as we move into the other talks. But for now, just happy to be with your bodies and your practice. So thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.